the underground bunker of the Civitas Studio in Raleigh, North Carolina. It's Civitalk with your hosts, Brooke Medina and Ray Nothstein. We're here to connect culture with civics, making it relevant to your daily life. And dare we say, existence at a time where too many are triggered and offended. So, relax. But buckle up and let's wade into the deep end. What's really happening in your old North State?
Welcome to the 42nd edition of Civitalk. We're going to look at Mother's Day, some things about Mother's Day and just sort of the meaning behind it and some stories as well. And the potential controversy, drag queen controversy at a Durham charter school. We'll touch on the student loan crisis and what's going on in North Carolina with our U.S. senators. Brooke and I are going to look at that for a moment and just kind of round out our day with that. So thank you for joining us. Brooke, do you know what is significant about the number 42?
Bush 40? No, he's 43. I'm 41. 42. You're going to be that in 2 years.
That is a good answer, but that's not what I was looking for. 42 is the number that is retired by all of Major League Baseball.
Oh, whose number was that?
Jackie Robinson.
Really?
Yeah.
So. I did not know that.
It's just kind of
Why'd you have to ask me a sports question?
Because that's I knew you wouldn't sexist. Get it. I knew
that
you wouldn't
very
get it.
Sexist. The show is over.
Yeah. I knew you wouldn't get a sports question. I mean, I didn't ask you a fashion question because you're like an expert on that, right?
Oh, speaking of fashion, Ray and I were talking about the Met.
You didn't know what that was. That kind of surprised me. I thought you were this like...
I like fashion that's actually
sophisticated.
Wearable.
Well, yeah, I looked through some
that's
of those.
That's not wearable.
And some of them are pretty bad.
So what Ray's talking about is, what was it called? The Met Gala?
Met Gala,
which
yeah.
is this big fashion show. All these celebrities come out and they wear the most outrageous outfits that their designer can create. And so anyways, there were a lot of different
My favorite was
choices.
The tuxedo with like the butt hugger shorts. The butt hugger shorts. I mean, yeah, some guy was wearing a tuxedo, but these like really, really like skin tight. Butt hugger shorts.
That is just so ew. That's so ew.
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah. So, yeah, we can talk about that later. But if you check out that Twitter hashtag, I think it's a Met Gala. There were some crazy fashion choices. But otherwise,
was
I
there
do
anything you would wear to a Civitas event that you saw? I don't know. I saw a couple of things. Someone had a nice like blue gown and actually,
really?
I mean, I don't remember this because I don't know celebrities real well. But someone had a like really, I thought, attractive blue gown.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, if it was classy looking and elegant, I would totally wear it.
Right. And then someone had
but
a severed
But most of what I saw was not.
Some actor, I recognize him, but I didn't know him. He had like a severed head of himself. He was
Wasn't that one of the Kardashians brothers?
I have no idea.
I think so. So anyways, there were some crazy things out there. But hey, if you saw the Met Gala or saw the photos, just go ahead and like enter those comments in during the Facebook Live feed, or you can always email us or something. But anyways, Ray, what are you doing this weekend?
I am... gonna chill, I think, somewhat. Probably watch some sports of something at some point. The Hurricanes, they're playing an important series against the Boston Bruins. So everybody down here in North Carolina, you know, there's a big kerfuffle going on about that, a little bit rivalry going on. I guess a sports journalist hung up on a reporter. Was it for the
News and Observer reporter?
Reporter who covered the Hurricanes?
Yes. So he hung up on the NNO reporter. Because of his accent. But the journalist... that covers NNO hockey sports stuff.
Yeah, I don't know his name.
He's actually from Detroit, though.
So I've actually met him. I met him when I went to that event.
Did he develop a southern accent?
No, I didn't.
So that Boston guy was just being cranky and shady.
Yeah,
so.
No, there's a lot of cranky and shadiness in Boston. It's a great town to visit, but it's not somewhere I'd want to live. And I've been there a lot in my life, but it's a cool history and a great city, but people aren't really that nice in Boston.
Mm-hmm. At least down here in the South, we fake being nice, right?
Yeah,
we
right,
pretend
exactly.
to be nice.
So let's delve into Mother's Day because that's coming up. And I know that you're a mother of four children. Mm-hmm. I know that you use your kids a lot for political purposes. We're getting out of that. That's a joke, folks.
That's a total joke. Yeah. There's a long story behind
There's
that.
There's a style. I think we addressed that once before on the podcast, but that was one of the before I knew Brooke real well, and I saw she got called out for... Her kids were involved.
My kids were in a political ad before I started working here at Civitas, and I wanted to expose them to our elected officials, and so it was an opportunity to do a photo shoot.
So I didn't know if Brooke's kids were real for a while, or they were just these like political
kids.
Yeah,
they're like poster
that she was renting
kids. It was my rent-a-kid.
Yeah.
So anyways, Mother's Day is coming up, and we wanted to talk a little bit about ways in which our mothers have the lessons that they have passed along to us. So before we get into the politics, we just wanted to take a moment to honor mothers and honor our moms in particular. So Ray, what is one of the most valuable lessons your mom has taught you?
Well, I would say it's certainly, I think the most valuable lesson has been faith. I mean, that's been, that's something that can't be, matched in any way. Certainly her unconditional love for me growing up, I think is just something that stayed with me. So you learn a lot of things about nurturing, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You learn about qualities in terms of just that your mom's there for you. There was an interesting piece, I don't know, you probably saw it, Brooke, but Russell Moore wrote it, and it was on the ERLC website.
Mm-hmm. And ethics.
I just wanted to read. I thought it was interesting because he talks about how grown men, this certainly happens on the battlefield. I remember reading a book about the AIDS crisis in San Francisco and New York, basically last year, I think it was. And it talked about these men, many of them homosexuals, but they were dying of AIDS and that they were crying out for their mom. And you see that sometimes on the battlefield too, yep. Where men who were, serious combat wound that often proves fatal as they're crying out for their mom. I mean, it's been portrayed in Hollywood movies too. But Russell Moore wrote this: in our culture, Mother's Day is a time in which each of us thinks about the woman who gave us life. As we honor her, perhaps we can remember that we will one day, should the Lord not return before lay dying, we will carry our cross right to the valley of the shadow of death. And we just might end this earthly life crying out for mama. Like Jesus, that just might be God's gracious way of reminding us we are not alone, that we are loved and known, even when we cannot help ourselves at all. Maybe our crying mama is God's way of showing us where we started, of reminding us that we have a father too.
Hmm. Wow.
So that's how he ended that piece. And it was just, he basically talked about, he went through some biblical themes, but opened up about this aspect of grown men and adults crying out for their mom late in life when they're dying.
Yeah. So. Yeah, well, there's just, like you talked about at the beginning, there's this nurturing element. I know that after becoming a mother, that was something that was just really transformed me as I had children, because you, as a father would too, but it's just in a different way. You would so quickly lay down your life for your child, and there is just nothing that will, that they could do that can make you love them less. It doesn't mean you don't fail. You don't Sure. have moments where you lost your temper at your child or just failed to be that mom that you always aspire to be. But there's just so much grace between that child-mother relationship that I am so grateful for, and it has taught me so much as a mom. But one of there were two lessons I've learned so much from my mom, but two that really stood out to me as I was thinking about this was, first, my mom taught me how to work really hard, but also play really hard. And she exemplified this just in our home all of the time. So,
see, my mom was great because she spoiled me. She made my bed when I came home from college.
Yeah, my mom didn't do that. No,
so, my mom was the best because she spoiled me not only as a child, but all the way through college.
Well, thank you, I'm sure, to your mom. Ray is really appreciative of that. But so my mom, if I did not vacuum the living room properly the first time, yep. I had to continue to do it over and over and over again until I did it right. Just anything in the house, if there was a chore that wasn't done right, she said, you need to either do it in excellence or you're going to sit here and you're going to keep doing it until you do. And so that was a really good lesson. I didn't like it at the time, but as an adult, that has been invaluable in, I would say, cultivating a strong work ethic. But another thing, though, was that we played hard, too. So we would stay up till wee hours in the morning sometimes playing Mario. She was a fun mom. We would have kitchen dance parties. And
yeah, and your mom looks like she's your younger sister. Because I met her at Costco recently. Yeah. I met her once before, but I saw her at Costco, and I couldn't remember her face, and I recognized her face, but I didn't associate it with Brooke. And she said that it was Brooke's mom. She said it was Brooke's mom, and I was like, no, you can't be. This is not right.
Well, Mom, if you're listening, that's, I'm sure, your compliment that
I'm sucking up to Tillis. The way Tillis sucks up to Trump. We'll get to that later. Yeah.
But speaking of that, so my mom used to be a model, though, and she actually gave up her modeling career when I was a baby. And
I haven't given up my modeling career yet. Still, but that's agents or agents out there, if you want a good prospect.
Can I finish telling my story?
Yeah, sorry.
Thank you. So anyways, that speaks to just the sacrifice that she was willing to make, and I know so many mothers do. And so that taught me a lot. But one last thing that she taught me before we move on, but she really drove home the point of how you teach people how to treat you, and you are the one that has to hold your head up high and be someone that's worthy of respect, and then not just demand it in a rude sort of way, but carry yourself as a respectable young woman or young man, and hold your head up high and know that, you know, make choices that you're proud of. And so those were some powerful lessons that she taught me growing up, and I am so grateful for my mama.
Yeah, amen. And I'd like to thank my mom especially for she didn't work outside the home.
She worked.
So, yeah,
it was
she
just
worked.
Not outside of the home.
No, that's what I said. She didn't work outside the home. Yeah. She worked inside the home, and that was a big blessing for my brother and I. And, you know, sometimes you don't realize that when you're growing up. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you like, I want more space, or I want this or that. Part of it, I don't think, you know, my dad was a pilot, so he was gone a lot. He was deployed a lot. So we needed her there, and she was a rock for us. And so it was
so both of our moms were blessing. Military wives.
Yeah.
Yep. And we understand, actually, today's Military Spouses Day. So Mary, that's your mom's name,
yes,
right?
Yes, Mary.
And then my mom, Lisa, thank you both for your service. We appreciate that. But okay, well, let's go ahead, and we want to talk about this event because we know this will rile a lot of parents up, and rightfully so. But can you uncover this Pride and Liberation event that's going on at a Durham taxpayer-funded charter school?
Yeah, the school is the Central Park School in Durham, and so they're going to have a drag queen story hour. It looks like it was a week-long event. I don't remember the fellow's name that helped organize it, but he's a teacher on staff there at the school, and they're going to have this big Pride and Liberation event where students are going to be introduced to drag queens. There'll be a drag queen, like I mentioned, storytelling time. It looks like they may be just kind of going into some of that lifestyle and you know, how they have to be accepting of that lifestyle and how that lifestyle will benefit them in some ways, at least having a knowledge of it. For kindergarten through eighth grade.
And they don't even teach sex education until what, seventh grade?
Right. When I was in Hawaii, Planned Parenthood came to my class in seventh grade, and I would have to say that was pretty intense.
Yeah. And to think that kids are going to be shocked and exposed to this, all in the name of the self-professed aim is inclusion and appreciation of diversity. But where does this stop? I mean, really, the whole drag culture is surrounding sexualizing a woman's body by a man choosing to dress up in a sexual way.
Yeah,
that's a good way. There is no way to separate it from this sort of very, very adult and content that typically surrounds the whole drag queen culture. And so for children to be exposed to that, for parents to sign off on it, for taxpayers to fund the schools that are actually promoting these sort of events, mm-hmm. there's a lot of issues that go along with that. But AP Dillon, who writes at Lady Liberty 1885, I think is her website.
I believe that's
she
right.
uncovered this and has been covering it for us.
Yeah, if you want to read and get the big info on this event, you should definitely check out her post. It's very comprehensive. It's extensive. She talks about the white privilege and some of the intersectionality issues that they're going to be educating these young kids on. Mm-hmm. So you can just go read her post and talk about it or to learn more about it. And I think it's just kind of, even for Durham, you know, we mm-hmm. all have kind of cliches about Durham and this or that. Durham's a little bit out of touch with the rest of North Carolina. To me, it just seemed very extreme mm-hmm. to foist. Anytime you sexualize kids, I mean, I know we've talked about this on the podcast before, but, you know, you should, I think, put up a stop sign.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever your agenda is, whatever you're trying to do in terms of, you know, from a broader term, maybe just the sexual revolution. But anytime you're involving kids in that, you should put up a big stop sign and say, yeah. Is this beneficial for this kid? Is it beneficial to open them up to this sort of sexualized culture?
Well, and it's so pervasive. Not even if your school doesn't have a drag queen story hour, and as a parent, I would hope that if your child does go to a school like that, you're at the front lines fighting that. But also just the access to pornography that children have nowadays, that what's on cable television, Netflix, if you don't have filters on, it's just our children are, it's this, these attacks from all different angles, and it's just the sexual,
yeah.
I guess, perversion has just pervaded so many aspects of culture. And so it's difficult to raise a child during this time,
yeah,
but we need to be vigilant.
Absolutely. And you and I talked about, I can't remember the name, but the individual, I think there was a Netflix documentary series on it.
Desmond
the
Amazing. That little boy. Yeah.
It's just so sad to watch stuff.
He was
like an
11-year-old boy, I think.
Looks like
11,
he has like an eating disorder. And
dressed in drag a lot. So just sad stuff. We as parents and just as concerned citizens need to stand in the gap for these kids and make sure that we're protecting and guarding their innocence.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Brooke. Just like you said, guard their innocence and give them space to be kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's what we need to do, and that's what we should all be doing as parents, is encouraging that kind of behavior instead of just trying to introduce them to the sexual themes.
Right. Absolutely. So let's go ahead, though, and we're not going to keep camping on that. We do want to talk about something because it is right in line with graduations these upcoming weeks. So this weekend there's a number of college and high school graduations. Do you remember your graduation very well, your high school one?
I do remember my high school graduation. I remember college graduation. I remember seminary graduation. I think my favorite may have been the college graduation.
Really? Okay. So after you got your bachelor's.
Yeah. So I am James Barksdale, who is the founder of Netscape.
Okay.
You guys remember Netscape out there?
Yeah. I still have a Netscape email address.
Yeah. He was an alumnus. He was an alumnus of the university that I graduated from, and he gave the commencement address. And it actually was really good, even though it was kind of secular, as most secular school commencement addresses would be. His kind of main theme was keep the main theme. The main thing in your life, and so whatever that was.
I mean, pastor used to preach on that.
That's it was kind of a broad. You could put whatever you wanted, right. Package that in whatever way you wanted to. But I thought the talk was actually good, and I don't know much about James Barksdale the person, but mm-hmm. I do remember the address, and I thought it was good. I actually remember that address more than the seminary, who was, I believe it was Bishop Al Gwynn of the United Methodist Church, who gave a good address too. But I don't remember it quite as well as the college one.
So, you know, speaking of graduations, though, there's a lot of students that are going to be leaving college, and in about 6 months, they're going to have to start paying interest on their student loans. Ooh. And Ray and I have had this discussion before, just the pervasiveness and the crisis that is these student loans. I think in a lot of ways, it mirrors the housing crisis in 2008. There are some differences, but there's a lot of predatory lending going on. So we can talk about that a little bit, yep. But I wanted to give you a few numbers. The average student loan debt in the United States is $37,000. So students are already finishing up maybe at 22 years of age, entering into their career if they find a job, which the job market's great right now. So it's almost inevitable to find a job, but they're starting life with $37,000 in debt. Some 5% of those degree earners actually have up to $100,000 in debt. That's a lot of burden to carry into your very first working years. And then one more stat before we actually just talk about this. Brookings Institute estimates that nearly 40% of borrowers will default by 2023. Wow. Almost half of all borrowers. So that's where this is a crisis that is looming, impending, and in some ways resembles that housing crisis because people aren't going to be able to pay their loans.
Yeah, there was a Wall Street Journal article, I think it was last year, about a man in Southern California who had over $1 million in student loan debt.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
How many degrees did he get?
Well, he was an MD, but he wasn't making huge money because I think he was still in his residency program. But,
over
you know,
$1 million.
Could you imagine how much the interest is going to accumulate on that?
That's so disheartening. A lot of them aren't going to be paying off their loans until they're well into their 50s anyways. And so just to think about that, you can't get a home loan, or maybe you're delaying marriage or childbearing because of this. And that's sad. My wife went
to a private law school, so I know a little bit about this issue.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's an important issue. And it's something that I think, you know, Brooke and I, we talked about this a little bit, I think, is that conservatives have to be a little bit better at addressing this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not giving a pass to the kids, but I think there's a lot of people or young people taking out student loans and they don't really realize what they're doing. Thankfully, I had a dad who preached to me the importance of thrift.
Mm-hmm.
And that really had a big, you know, that had a big impression in my life, I think, and just sort of some of those principles about savings and about investing and about not going into debt. And debt is a curse. If you read through scripture, you realize that pretty quick. I mean, anytime they talk about debt, it's always a curse. And one thing I would say is I think there's a lot of people that haven't gotten that kind of message from a father or from a family member about how much of a curse debt can be. And they just think, oh, it'll be easy to pay back. And they don't realize what they're doing. And it's too late oftentimes.
Yeah, well, and they I think that college has been pushed so much. There's a place for college and certain careers that you go into. You do need a college degree for, but college has so been pushed on the American people and the millennials and Generation Z that there's this expectation that everyone should go to college and that's the only path towards success.
Sure.
And I believe that needs to be pushed against because there are some people that they make it maybe halfway through college and they've already given up because they realize that's not where their passion lies. They would much rather just learn a trade, but they're already maybe $20,000 in debt. Yeah. And so we've created these expectations that really aren't fair, and they're not in keeping with people's human natures. And some people are just designed differently, and college is not necessary for them. Yet we've kind of pigeonholed them into this one particular path. And that's part of the problem, as well as government lending.
Yep.
There is, so the government has created a lot of this problem, I would say.
And the schools. The schools
the in-state
capitalize
colleges,
on it.
Right. Well, because they raise their tuition to what they know that the government can shell out as well. Mm-hmm. And so there's this false market. It's not a free market.
Nope.
But student loan crisis. So Elizabeth Warren has talked about this. Bernie Sanders has talked about this, wherein they want to just create a free college or reparations of some form on this. But really, government was the problem that led to this in many ways. So what makes us think they're going to be an adequate
solution? Yeah, it's kind of like the
solution.
Housing crisis and many similarities with the housing crisis that happened during the Great Recession. I think, you know, Brooke, one of the things that we talked about briefly, and I didn't get to this before, I meant to get to it, was that I think conservatives need to be a little bit more compassionate on dealing with this issue. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you see on social media, you know, like, too bad, sucker, or suck it up, or it's your fault. And I think conservatives have to have a message on this issue and a plan to help people, especially people that are be starting college here in the fall, and get a message out on this and talk more about it, because it's such an important topic. And just getting on Twitter and acting smug and saying, well, too bad, so sad, I'm not paying your loans, or we're not bailing you out. You know, I agree with that in theory, but I think to be dismissive of people who, you're right, have gone through a system where college has been preached to them for so long. They've been, you know, inundated, like, you have to go to college and you have to do this. And, you know, families are preaching this and the public schools are preaching this so much. And we're not really educating the whole person in a way where they can even understand these loans that they're taking out, which shows a failure of the education system to some degree in itself. But I think it's important, really, to, I think, for the conservatives in this nation to have a little compassion on this issue and understand that there are folks that, you know, they just want to go to college and they want to, they want to get a degree, but they don't have the resources, or the resources aren't there. And you've got colleges that are just raking in money hand over fist because of the student loan false market that was created. And so, you know, I'd like to see some conservative politicians and some people in the public square, I think, have a little bit better compassion on this issue and speak to it in a way that, you know, just shows that this is a real concern, and it's not just a suck it up, you know, buttercup.
Right. Well, and we can learn from just being innovative in ways to reduce the cost of education. I think we can learn from the private sector and maybe even for-profit colleges. But really think about just the booming of online education and the reduced costs that we could have associated with that if there were some, if there was just some reevaluation, and maybe state colleges just started creating some sort of affordable degree programs that are exclusively online, doesn't require as many professors on campus, or, you know, that are just able to serve students that can only attend part-time because they don't want to take out big loans, and they can just charge for this at cost, because some people will still want that traditional college experience. So you will have people paying maybe those higher rates, but for those that, if we want to really make college affordable for people, there are other ways that don't involve government spending and more government obligations.
Yeah, and Glenn Reynolds of Instapundit's done a lot of good work on this on his site. And I think one of the things that he really highlights real well is he puts pressure back on the colleges, because they're the ones feeding up a lot of this market with, you know, creating these elaborate dorms and, you know, all these expansions, which hiring all kinds of administrators at the college, which, you know, passes more and more tuition costs onto the student. And, you know, I think he does a good job of actually, one of the things he talks about is colleges need to start putting some of their endowment money in a tuition assistance or tuition relief. And I think that's a great point. And, you know, it makes the college put a little bit more money where their mouth is on this issue. So,
well, even in North Carolina taxpayers put $3.1 billion, I think, into the UNC system. So a lot of this, taxpayers have an interest in making sure that we have an educated public, but we also have an interest in making sure that we're not creating these unsustainable financial disasters for the next generation by irresponsibly allowing colleges to, and just government to to have their own way and set their own prices that maybe aren't in keeping with affordability. So if it's a state college, I think there's a lot more pressure we can put on them to make it more
and
affordable.
And if you're $40, $80, $100,000 in debt, socialism is going to be appealing to you. I mean, let's just be honest about it. The message of Bernie Sanders where they talk about debt relief or wiping out your debt and we're going to come in and care for you and take care of your, you know, medical costs. We're going to take care of all these aspects of your life. If you are kind of swimming in debt, that kind of message is going to be appealing to young people. And that's why I think conservatives need to be interested in
having a good rebuttal.
Yeah, having a good rebuttal and having, you know, instead of this just sort of just dismissive rebuttal, like get out of my face, you deal with your debt on your own. Mm-hmm. You know, we have to start talking about this issue better. So
yes, agreed. So we could spend some time on that, but we actually want to talk about Senator Tillis. He is a freshman senator here in North Carolina, will be up for re-election in 2020. So we know somebody that's just decided to throw his hat in the primary race, and his name is Garland Tucker. He is a Wake County area businessman, and he will be challenging Senator Tillis. Garland Tucker is also a former board member of Civitas Institute. And so he's going to be challenging Tillis. We know Tillis's approval numbers have been dropping as of late.
Yeah, they're not good.
So give me your expert analysis on this.
Wow, you put me on the spot. Especially since, you know, I know Garland Tucker and we attend the same church. So, you know, I think it's not an easy race for him. I will say when the announcement was made, it looked like it leaked and there seemed to be a little bit of Tillis was able to get, you know, kind of highlight a op-ed that Garland Tucker wrote and kind of go on the offensive a little bit. And so it looked like that campaign getting out of the gate had a little bit of trouble. But, you know, anybody that knows Garland Tucker, he's a great guy. He's very, very intelligent. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting. He's very well connected. He knows everybody in the country, especially in the conservative movement and the Republican Party as well. So it'll be fascinating to watch. I think if he's able to capitalize on Tillis's unpopularity, he certainly, I think, has a chance to do well. So I guess my only question for Garland Tucker's campaign would be, can he broadly appeal statewide, you know, to voters in the mountains, to the hog farmer out east, or these other folks? I mean, he certainly is kind of a darling of the Triangle conservatives, and people know him well here. So is he able to get his campaign message out statewide and really challenge Tillis? Because Tillis is a very skilled politician. I know his numbers are down and they don't look great, but he's somebody that I think can rebound too, because you know, he understands politics. He's been in that game for a long time. He's a former speaker of the North Carolina House, and it'll be a fascinating race to watch. Mm-hmm.
It will. And so Carter Wren, who is Tucker's campaign manager, he actually acknowledged some of those challenges that you just mentioned. And so this is what he said in a News and Observer article: running against an incumbent is never easy. It's an uphill battle. But Tillis's weakness with conservative Republicans is encouraging. I wouldn't be supporting someone who wasn't to the right of Tillis. And so that's something that a lot of critics of Tillis's have accused him of, is just maybe being more wishy-washy on immigration or what they would like to see done with immigration. And then his Washington Post op-ed in response to the president's national emergency declaration, which also ties into immigration, which I also wrote on. You know, so there's some issues that some other Republicans have with Tillis. But like you said, his approval numbers are really, really low right now. It's 20. So we polled this back in March at the Civitas poll, and his favorability was at 26% at that point in time. And it had dropped 12 points because we had polled it in November as well. And so it was 38 at that time. So that's a big dip. Yeah,
no doubt. It'll be fascinating to watch, because, you know, to me, some of the most interesting thing about politics are political campaigns. And, you know, you actually have to ultimately go out there, put yourself out there and hustle for votes. So some people are good at that. Some people are the most brilliant people and they struggle with that. So it'll be fascinating to watch. And I think it'll probably end up being pretty close, because, like, you know, those numbers don't look good for Tillis going down the stretch. But, you know, there's time for him to turn that around.
Time,
and we're seeing him suck up to Donald Trump, right? I mean, he's doing that.
Yes.
You know, he's broken with our senior senator here in North Carolina, Richard Burr, on the subpoena for Donald Trump Jr. Mm-hmm. and is backing Meadows and, you know, other sort of people that are big fans of Trump. And so there's a split a little bit with those two senators on this issue. I mean, certainly Tillis is trying to cast himself as the Trump ally, as you mentioned, that he wasn't initially in some ways.
Right, right. So we'll see what happens. But that is the latest on one of our two North Carolina senators, what's going on with their campaign. So we are actually out of time for this week, but we appreciate you guys joining
us. Happy Mother's Day to all the wonderful mothers out there, and we hope you're blessed. And thank you for joining us. Check out all our content at nccivitas.org.
Have a good week, y'all.